Hey, Robert?
Yes,
Hey,
Adam.
yes, how are you today?
Pretty good.
Good. Thank you again for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah. So I write a we I'm the publisher of a local news organization in Westchester in the Hudson Valley, New York, north of the city.
Okay.
But I also write a weekly column called Stone's Throw, where I do a deep dive on a specific topic. It's a reporting-based opinion column, and I'm taking on UAPs, UFOs this week, and I've been doing a decent amount of research. And I found your organization, and maybe a way to start is if you could briefly explain the mission and goals of your coalition, and any recent particularly relevant findings or research and something along those lines. Very good. And maybe you could just sort of that nutshell elevator pitch version of your bio and how you became interested in the study of UAPs.
Okay, so for my bio, my degree's in chemistry, and I worked in the semiconductor field, which is what some people also call nanotechnology today. I was an engineering manager. I worked on flash memory devices as well as microprocessors. I worked at a company called Advanced Micro Devices. And I also was over the research and development lab that we had for a period of time. And so that was just advanced work we did on related to nanotechnologies. I became interested probably when I read J. Allen Hynek's book as a teenager, and that's called The UFO Experience. But I put that aside until I retired early from the semiconductor field. And then I, just sat down and said, what do I want to do, with my time? And one of the things that I wanted to do was investigate the UAP subject. And that was 16 years ago. So I probably average 20 hours a week on the UAP subject since that time. And I've written a couple of books, and I've got a third one coming out. And when I first started looking at it, it was just, okay, is there something to this or not? And once I researched it enough, then I felt like there was. So that's, and I was first became involved in an organization called MUFON. I was their director of research for 10 years, but I just felt like I never could get science incorporated into the organization. So I left MUFON in 2017, and then that's when myself and two other individuals initially formed the SCU, the Scientific Coalition.
For people new to the topic, what are some of the most compelling cases or evidence that the SCU has encountered in its research? Maybe sharing some specific examples. And obviously, if you're doing 20 hours, a week of research, you could take a really nuanced deep dive. This is a general interest newspaper. So I'd like, if you could sort of split that difference of sharing the important technical facts, but also sort of that, bird's eye view as well.
Okay, yeah, I'll try to do that. So if it gets too technical on something, just let me know. I would say one of the most significant UAP events in history, which the history goes back to 1942 of the modern era, which that 2004 event that many people may be aware of that came out in the New York Times in December of 2017. And this was about an event that occurred off the southwest coast of California. It involved a United States carrier strike force, and the head of the strike force was the USS Nimitz, and the missile frigate accompanying it was the USS Princeton. And those were the two key ships involved, although there were other ships in the strike force. And then the F-18s that were on the USS Nimitz. So those are the three key involvements. And it was an incident where they're doing military maneuvers. They're getting ready to be sent to the Middle East. And right before a military maneuver is going to occur, the USS Princeton had detected objects at extremely high altitude, 80,000 feet or above. And they basically ignored them because they were outside of their operating area for their jets. But right before this jet program was about to begin, the Princeton's radar detected these objects dropping down to 28,000 feet and lower. So that put them in the same airspace as the jet, so it became a safety concern. So they got permission to send two F-18 fighter jets to the nearest of these unknown objects that had dropped down into their airspace. And that's the one that the New York Times focuses on. And it involved a guy by the name of Commander Fravor, who's the commander of the squadron, his second in command, and two other pilots who were on these two jets. And they encountered what they described as this tic-tac-shaped object. So, in other words, the Princeton sees its target on radar 50 miles away. The jets go to the target, and the Navy pilots see an object there that the radar directed them to. And this object is basically moving randomly and making sudden turns and accelerations that no aircraft can make. And that's when the commander decides to drop down from his altitude of 20,000 feet down towards this object, which was near the ocean. And he begins to move to the object. The object turns towards him and begins to move up towards his aircraft. And at that point in time, when they came within half a mile of each other, he decided to cut across directly towards the object, and it basically moved its nose slightly and accelerated away, disappeared from sight within 1 to 2 seconds. But what's noteworthy about that incident is the acceleration that these objects demonstrated. Like our fighter jets, if they're accelerating in a straight line, they're not going to accelerate more than maybe 2 G's. And 1 G is the amount of force that gravity pulls on your body. 2 G's would mean you weigh twice what you normally weigh on the same scales.
Could those speeds be quantified in miles per hour, which might be easier for the average person to comprehend?
Yeah, acceleration is different than speed.
I see. Right.
Because acceleration is like whether you're speeding up or slowing down. Like if your car hits a brick wall at 50 miles an hour, you're going to...
How many times faster was this acceleration compared to human known acceleration?
It was from the human type acceleration 100 times faster, 100 times greater. So two orders of magnitude more acceleration than human acceleration. In terms of velocity, what we measured the speed. So if you want to know a speed played to it, the speeds of these objects was between 30 and 50,000 miles an hour. So you're talking about Mach 20 to Mach 40.
What's the fastest human known miles per hour for the same?
A hypersonic missile in the high upper atmosphere, not at lower atmosphere, but in the high upper atmosphere, can reach speeds of 6,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
But the difference was this was in the lower atmosphere. Like if you took a hypersonic missile and you tried to have it accelerate like that at altitudes of 10 or 20,000 feet, the metal would just begin to melt.
So then what would be the equivalent in that part of the atmosphere for known human...
Lower atmosphere, nothing we have will go faster than 2,000 miles per hour in the lower atmosphere. Like, if you can fire a missile, which can reach, speeds of, 4, 5, 6,000 miles an hour, but they're moving upwards. But by the time they hit those speeds, they have left the lower atmosphere. But, like the F-16, the F-15, some of those jets can reach Mach 3 speeds. I think they can in the lower atmosphere, which would be about 2,000 miles an hour.
I'd like to see if in the plainest English possible, we could talk and sort of separate the euphemistic, UAPs with more like plain English, average Jane, average Joe, summaries of taking this leap of what you just described in incredible fashion as to intelligent life specifically. In other words, if someone, hears this account, it's incredibly convincing. Not convincing, it is what it is. It's the facts. But I'm saying, can we take that leap in non-euphemistic language, describing why that means that there's intelligent non-human life?
Right. So the reason there's intelligent non-human life is because it requires intelligence to take a physical object and accelerate it at great speed. So we are not aware of any non-intelligent apparatus that can suddenly accelerate, right? So it requires intelligence to move an object at high speed and high acceleration.
Wow, that was beautifully said. I guess a related, sort of interrelated question I might have is, as humans, as people, should we be exhilarated or terrified by this, or both?
Good question. It depends on the person, I guess. But I would say that we should be exhilarated, or we should be excited to know that there is another intelligence besides just ourselves. It poses all sorts of new frontiers and challenges. The likelihood is that any unknown intelligence is probably going to be benevolent or friendly. And there's an argument for that. And the argument assumes that any unknown intelligence comes from another star system.
That's amazing. And I guess the other question is, you know, that sort of speaks to the exploration, the natural human desire to explore and learn more as far as the why we should be exhilarated. But could you take that a step further and like draw it to people's personal lives of why beyond the fascination, why we should be hopeful or beyond hopeful, we know in a sense. So, and why that's a net positive for humanity?
Oh, man, that's a tough question. I'm trying to think how to answer it. Ask me that question again, maybe something
else. Sure. Right. So the premise of what you described of why we should be exhilarated and not terrified in part was largely about the exciting nature of learning more. And then, you know, you made the point about the benevolence, which is slightly closer to my question. But, you know, for example, like, and this might produce some thoughts, like medical breakthroughs that could, let's say, be theoretically, you know, something in that realm of why, as a scientist, you would think it would be people should be excited about this reality that we're learning about.
Okay, yeah.
Does that make sense? The question, at least, even if it's a tough answer.
Your question makes perfect sense, and I'm trying to think of an answer that goes beyond just, you know, we do it for the curiosity and you know, because we love to explore. Okay, so here's another view that I have on it. Part of the value in making contact with another intelligence someday is that it forces us to put ourselves in the position that we are one people or species that represents this planet. When the day comes and we meet some other intelligence, it's not going to be a meeting between 150 nation states and this other intelligence. It will be a meeting between the human race and whatever this intelligence is. And so it has a side benefit of bringing us together as a people rather than, you know, 150 different little warring factions. So that's what I see as a net benefit, besides just the value of exploration and curiosity.
That's fascinating. So, you know, even some of the racial issues we go through, it could apply to that in a sense. That's really interesting. Yeah. That's and what about like practical stuff like medicine, for example? Like, is there something there too?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, that's actually a very difficult question because on the one hand, we might hope that another civilization provides us new technological know-how, whether it's medicine or spacecraft or what have you. But on the other hand, that's a negative factor because then it discourages us to develop and learn new things if someone else already has it and just hands it to us. So that's actually a very difficult question. I mean, because it involves a lot of different possibilities, right? And it might very well be that another intelligence would be cognizant of the fact that just providing us technology might not be the best thing for us as a civilization.
Would you measure, you talked about a future where we'd be in contact with intelligent life, and obviously we can't know the unknown, but do you forecast that in decades, generations, millennia, months, days? Like, can you give me some sense of time in that standpoint?
I would think that we will have made contact with another intelligence sometime, I would say, in the next 50 to 100 years. So I expect that it will be a while. I don't think that it will occur anytime soon, but there's no way to truly predict that, right? It could happen tomorrow.
What do you base that? I mean, 50 to 100 years sounds very close to me. So that's, I actually look at it from that standpoint. So what, and I get, I'm not like, you know, no one would hold you to that, but just to give a sense of that timeline, like what draws you to that general conclusion?
So I'm looking at our ability to detect extrasolar planets that have life on them. And I think within 50 years, we will be able to identify planets similar to the Earth around nearby star systems. And I think once we do that, then we will probably make a concerted effort to try to communicate with those star systems, you know, with the planets on that star system. That's one way that it could happen. The second way it could happen would be if an intelligence from another star system comes here to us, right? And any intelligence that does that, by definition, will be much more advanced than us in the order of several hundred years. And so to give you a feel of what that's like, imagine the difference between our society today and our Earth society 200 or 300 years ago. So there would be a huge difference, and it would be them that would make the decision that they want to communicate. And I would suspect part of their decision would be whether or not they felt that communication would be helpful or harmful to our society.
Right. Interesting. Is there a part of this topic that you think that I haven't asked about yet that you think is particularly important to communicate with the general public that you would want to comment on and question you would ask yourself if the shoe was on the other foot?
Yeah, I think this is kind of a big picture view, but as you look at how we deal with the subject of an unknown intelligence, you see that national security is our number one concern, whether it's the United States or China or Russia. And national security is the concern because we don't want one of our enemies on planet Earth to learn something that we don't learn, and vice versa. And so that just tells you where we are at this point as a species, right? And so that is, I think, one of the biggest things to take away from this, even more so than the issue of, you know, have we been contacted by an unknown intelligence or not, but the way we react to it. We don't react to it as a single species. There's no United Nations effort. It's, in the case of the United States, it's like everything is cloaked under national security because of concerns of China and Russia learning something. And I'm sure the same is true for them.
So even if that's an understandable reaction in one sense, at least politically, it's sort of an indictment on our species in a sense, the reaction.
Right. We're very far away from where we need to be if we want to make contact with another intelligent species.
Wow. What's the best way to address skeptics. Like, how does the SCU address or try to mitigate skepticism of your work?
So, most of the SCU members are skeptics also. I mean, that's what science is to be skeptical. But there's a difference between being skeptical and not being open to possibilities. So, most of the individuals that you hear that are, I guess you could call it, anti-UAP. It's very similar to people who are what I call true believers. In other words, they want to believe wholeheartedly that, you know, some alien race is going to come save us, and you can't convince them otherwise. And it's the same thing with what I call the debunkers, which to me is more than just a skeptic. They're the same way. There's no way you can convince them otherwise that there's a possibility that what we're dealing with is an unknown intelligence. And so the way SCU deals with this is we deal with it purely from the way science should deal with a subject. Anything that's a possibility, and you look at, you know, what are the most likely possibilities, and then you investigate it and see, you know, what evidence is there to support
it. Are you still there, or did you just cut out?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm still here. The right. Last thing I said was, you know, we investigate to see what evidence is available to support a given hypothesis.
Right. That makes sense.
So, like, for me personally, I think the most likely hypothesis that explains UAP is, you know, an extraterrestrial hypothesis from another solar system. But that doesn't mean that is the actual answer, right? That's just a hypothesis. And until you prove it, it's still a hypothesis.
What does proof look like other than an encounter, like in terms of the difference between belief and knowing?
I'm sorry, say it again, Adam.
Like, you know, there's sort of a difference between believing something to be true and knowing something to be true. And is there anything short of an encounter with this intelligent life that arrives, that brings us to that place that you were talking about of being closer to knowing?
That's a very good question, because the answer to that question, the difference between knowing and believing, is going to vary by the person, even for scientists. For me personally, if I'm able to establish that an object can move in ways that no one on Earth is capable of making an object move, then to me that's an unknown intelligence. Someone else may, to be convinced, they would have to see the object stop, you know, land in front of them, and someone gets out, and, you know, it would take that level. But it's a good question, right? Because you can take all the scientific equipment that you have at your disposal, right? And you take data collection on an object that's in the sky. But how does that, no matter what you measure in terms of speeds, acceleration, or anything else, you can't absolutely prove that that is an object from another star system, right? There's no way to prove that other than if the object lands and you communicate with it, and that's what they tell you. Otherwise, you're just collecting information that says, here's something that's in our atmosphere, and we cannot mimic it, but we don't know what it is.
Amazing.
It's a tough question, because here's the difference that the position science is in that it has never been in before. Normally with science, you're in control of what you're investigating, whether it's butterfly or whether it's an earthquake or what have you, you're able to measure and come to conclusions about it. But if you're dealing with something that's more intelligent than you, that's something we've never dealt with in terms of how does science deal with that, right? Because in a way, it's like the scientists in the lab with some rats, but in this case, we're the rats. And how do we do a scientific evaluation of the scientist who's evaluating us?
Right. That's a crazy way to think about it. It'd be like the rats doing their own lab work on humans or something like that. Yeah.
Right. How do they, draw their conclusions? And that's kind of, if you assume that we are dealing with an intelligence far advanced than us, how do you, you're left somewhat at the, at the disposal of that intelligence as to what it wants to do.
That's mind-blowing to think about. Wow. Is there any picture you might be able to email me that could best accompany an article on this topic?
Okay, I'm trying to think what type of picture would be good. Let's see. I don't think there's there's photographs, you've probably seen them, of like still shots of those videos. I mean, you could always do that. I was trying to think of something maybe more unique or different. I'm just thinking out loud here, Adam, so you may have some thoughts on this too. I mean, I could send you a graph that looks at how much time a scientist has put into studying UAP versus the likelihood that the scientist believes there's something to the subject or that there's not anything to the subject, right? So it really depends on your article and how you're going to portray it. What do you have in mind?
Yeah, well, that would be great. Like maybe after we get off, at your convenience, if you send me two or three, pictures or even one would be great that you have access to. In terms of the article, it's talking to local people, talking to experts like you, my own sort of takeaway and perspective, looking at the issue. So it's sort of like almost anything could work because it's a very general, piece.
Right. I'll send you two or three different things and then you can kind of pick one.
Great. That would be great. I love that. Yeah. And don't assume I have anything. Like if you have one of those, Navy pictures or something like access to or something like that, anything that you think would be compelling. But I agree it could be cool to have something that hasn't been all over the place. So if there's some graph or something like that, that could be really cool.
Yeah. So I'll do that. Anything I send you up will be something, that's in the public domain
right.
or the controls that you can
right. Perfect. Well, this is, I could talk to you for hours, and it's always so frustrating when you got to boil it all down, as opposed to like a podcast or something where people could hear our whole conversation because I have 100 more questions. But thank you so much for taking the time. I usually end up like texting sources afterwards with quick, little tiny follow-ups. But, I'll be sure to text you a link to the article once it publishes, and I really appreciate you sharing.
Yeah, I'd love to read it. I'll put a link to it to our membership so that they can all read it also.
Oh, that would be beautiful. Thank you so much, Robert. This has been incredible. I really thank you.
Well, enjoy the conversation.
Absolutely. Oh, and to clarify, do I title you as a doctor? I wasn't quite sure from...
I am not a doctor. I do not have a... Most, like I said, 30% of our membership do have PhDs.
Right.
But I do have a PhD. So, yeah, don't call me a doctor.
Okay. All right. Got it. Just wanted to be sure either way. All right. Yeah, very good. Thank you so much again for your time. And you don't mind if I shoot you quick text just in case something comes up, do you?
Yeah, if you have some questions, you shoot me a text or what have you.
Okay. All right. Have a great afternoon.
All
All right. Talk soon. Take care. Thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye.